Chapter 7. The Secret of Good Delivery. Know the fact. Hug the fact. For the essential thing is heat, and heat comes from sincerity. Ralph Waldo Emerson. It is necessary to have something more than knowledge of the subject. You must have earnestness in its presentation. You must feel that you have something to say that people ought to hear. William Jennings Bryan. Do one thing at a time, and do that one thing as if your life depended upon it. Motto of Eugene Grace, president of the Bethlehem Steel Company. He is a benefactor to mankind who contracts the great rules of life into short sentences that they may be easily impressed on the memory and so recur habitually to the mind. Samuel Johnson. The ability to express an idea is as important as the idea itself. Bernard Baruch. Chapter 7. The Secret of Good Delivery. Early in my career, I was asked by two explorers to help them prepare an illustrated travel talk of their flight and train them in the delivery of it. They gave it twice daily for 4 months in Philharmonic Hall, London, one speaking in the afternoon and the other at night. They had had identically the same experience, and they delivered the same talk, almost word for word. Yet, somehow, it didn't sound like the same talk at all. There is something besides the mere words in a talk which counts. It is the flavor with which they are delivered. It is not so much what you say as how you say it. I once sat beside a young woman at a public concert who was reading the notes of a mazurka by Chopin as Ignacy Paderewski, probably the finest pianist of his day, played them. She was mystified. She couldn't understand. His fingers were touching precisely the same notes that hers had touched when she had played it. Yet her rendition had been commonplace, and his was inspired, a thing of surpassing beauty, a performance that held the audience enthralled. It was not the mere notes that he touched. It was the way he touched them. A feeling, an artistry, a personality that he put into the touching that made all the difference between mediocrity and genius. Karl Bruloff, the great Russian painter, once corrected a pupil's study. The pupil looked in amazement at the altered drawing, exclaiming, "Why, you have touched it only a tiny bit, but it is quite another thing." Bruloff replied, "Art begins where the tiny bit begins." That is as true of speaking as it is of painting and of Paderewski's playing. The same holds true when one is touching words. There is an old saying in the English Parliament that everything depends upon the manner in which one speaks, and not upon the matter. Quintilian said that long ago when England was one of the outlying colonies of Rome. I have often noticed in college contests that it is not always the speaker with the best material who wins. Rather, it is the speaker who can talk so well that the material sounds best. Three things matter in a speech, one pundit observed. Who says it, how it is said, and what is said. And of the three, the last matters the least. An exaggeration? Yes, but scratch the surface of it and you will find the truth shining through. Edmund Burke wrote speeches so excellent in logic and reasoning and composition that they are today, more than two centuries later, studied as classic models of oration. Yet, Burke, as a speaker, was a notorious failure. He didn't have the ability to deliver his gems, to make them interesting and forceful. So he was called the dinner bell of the House of Commons. When he arose to talk, the other members coughed and shuffled and went out in droves. What is delivery? What does an automobile salesperson do when he or she delivers the car you have bought? Does the sales rep just throw you the keys and the sales papers and let it go at that? Is merely getting a thing out of one's own hands the same as getting it delivered? The messenger with an important document delivers it into the direct possession of the person for whom it is intended. Speakers are delivering a message, yet too often it does not reach the person or persons for whom it is intended. Let me give you an illustration that is typical of the fashion in which thousands of people talk. I happened on one occasion to be stopping in Murren, a small resort in the Swiss Alps. I was living at a hotel operated by a London company, and they usually sent out from England a couple of lecturers each week to talk to the guests. One of them was a well-known English novelist. Her topic was the future of the novel. She admitted that she had not selected the subject herself, and the long and short of it was that she had nothing to say about it that she really cared enough about saying to make it worthwhile expressing. She had hurriedly made some rambling notes, and she stood before the audience, ignoring her hearers, not even looking at them, staring sometimes over their heads, sometimes at her notes, sometimes at the floor. She called off her words into the primeval void with a faraway look in her eyes and a faraway ring in her voice. That kind of a performance isn't delivering a talk at all. It is a soliloquy. It has no sense of communication. And that is the first essential of good talking, a sense of communication. The audience must feel that there is a message being delivered straight from the mind and heart of the speakers to their minds and their hearts. That kind of a talk I have just described might as well have been spoken out in the sandy, waterless wastes of the Gobi Desert. In fact, it sounded as if it were being delivered in some such spot rather than to a group of living human beings. This matter of delivering a talk is, at the same time, a very simple and a very intricate process. It is also a very much misunderstood and abused one. The secret of good delivery. An enormous amount of nonsense and twaddle has been written about delivery. It has been shrouded in rules and rites and made mysterious. Go to a library or bookshop and look for volumes on oratory. Most are utterly useless. Old-fashioned oratory, in which the speaker engaged in verbal fireworks, like an actor in a Shakespearean play, will not be accepted by the sophisticated audiences today. A modern audience, regardless of whether it is 15 people at a business conference, or 1,000 people in an arena, or millions viewing it on their TV screens, wants the speakers to talk just as directly as they would in a chat, and in that same general manner that they would employ in speaking to one of them in conversation. In the same manner, but with considerably more force. In order to appear natural, speakers have to use much more energy in talking to 40 people than they do in talking to just one. Just as a statue on top of a building has to be of heroic size in order to make it appear of lifelike proportions to an observer on the ground. Speak to the members of your community association just as you would to John or Jane Smith. What is a meeting of the community association, after all, but a mere collection of John and Jane Smiths? Won't the same methods that are successful with those people individually be successful with them collectively? I have just described the delivery of a certain novelist. In the same ballroom in which she had spoken, I had the pleasure a few nights later of hearing Sir Oliver Lodge. His subject was Atoms and Worlds. He had devoted to it more than a half century of thought and study and experiment and investigation. He had something that was essentially a part of his heart and mind and life, something that he wanted very much to say. He forgot, and I, for one, thanked God that he did forget, that he was trying to make a speech. That was the least of his worries. He was concerned only with telling the audience about atoms, telling us accurately and lucidly and feelingly. He was earnestly trying to get us to see what he saw and to feel what he felt. And what was the result? He delivered a remarkable talk. It had both charm and power. It made a deep impression. He was a speaker of unusual ability, yet I am sure he didn't regard himself in that light. I am sure that few people who heard him ever thought of him as a public speaker at all. If you speak in public so that people hearing you will suspect that you have had training in public speaking, you will not be a credit to your instructor. To be truly effective, you must speak with such intensified and exalted naturalness that your auditors will never dream that you have been trained. A good window does not call attention to itself. It merely lets in the light. Good speakers are like that. They are so natural that their hearers never notice their manner of speaking. They are conscious only of the message. Henry Ford's advice. All Ford cars are exactly alike, said their maker, but no two people are just alike. Every new life is a new thing under the sun. There has never been anything just like it before, and never will be again. Each of us ought to get that idea about ourselves. We should look for the single spark of individuality that makes us different from the other folks, and develop that fully. Society and schools may try to iron it out of us. Their tendency is to put us all in the same mold. But I say don't let that spark be lost. It's your only real claim to importance. All that is doubly true of public speaking. There is no other human being in the world like you. Hundreds of millions of people have two eyes and a nose and a mouth, but none of them look precisely like you, and none of them have exactly your traits and methods and cast of mind. Few of them will talk and express themselves just as you do when you are speaking naturally. In other words, you have individuality. As a speaker, it is your most precious possession. Cling to it, cherish it, develop it. It is the spark that will put force and sincerity into your speaking. It is your only real claim to importance. The most famous debates ever held in America took place in 1858 in the prairie towns of Illinois between Senator Stephen A. Douglas and Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was tall and awkward. Douglas was short and graceful. These men were as unlike in their characters and mentality and personality and dispositions as they were in their physiques. Douglas was the cultured man of the world. Lincoln was the rail splitter who went to the front door in his bare feet to receive company. Douglas' gestures were graceful. Lincoln's were ungainly. Douglas was utterly destitute of humor. Lincoln was one of the greatest storytellers who ever lived. Douglas seldom used a simile. Lincoln constantly argued by analogy and illustration. Douglas was haughty and overbearing. Lincoln was humble and forgiving. Douglas thought in quick flashes. Lincoln's mental processes were much slower. Douglas spoke with the impetuous rush of a whirlwind. Lincoln was quieter and deeper and more deliberate. Both of these men, unlike as they were able speakers because they had the courage and good sense to be themselves. If either had tried to imitate the other, he would have failed miserably. But each one, by using to the utmost his own peculiar talents, made himself individual and powerful. Go thou and do likewise. That's an easy direction to give, but is it an easy one to follow? Most emphatically, it is not. As Marshal Foch said of the art of war, it is simple enough in its conception, but unfortunately complicated in its execution. It takes practice to be natural before an audience. Actors know that. When you were a little child, 4 years old, you probably could, had you but tried, have mounted a platform and recited naturally to an audience. But when you are 24 or 44, what will happen if you mount a platform and start to speak? Will you retain that unconscious naturalness that you possessed at 4? You may, but it is dollars to donuts that you will become stiff and stilted and mechanical and draw back into your shelf like a snapping turtle. The problem of teaching or of training people in delivery is not one of superimposing additional characteristics. It is largely one of removing impediments, of freeing them, of getting them to speak with the same naturalness that they would display if someone were to knock them down. Hundreds of times I have stopped speakers in the midst of their talks and implored them to talk like a human being. Hundreds of nights I have come home mentally fatigued and nervously exhausted from trying to drill and force my students to talk naturally. No, believe me, it is not so easy as it sounds. And the only way under high heaven by which you can get the knack of this enlarged naturalness is by practice. And as you practice, if you find yourself talking in a stilted manner, pause, and say sharply to yourself mentally, "Here, what is wrong? Wake up. Be human." Then, pick out someone in the audience, someone in the back, the dullest looking person you can find, and talk to that individual. Forget there is anyone else present at all. Converse. Imagine you are answering a question from that person. If he or she were to stand up and talk to you, and you were to respond, that process would immediately and inevitably make your talking more conversational, more natural, more direct. So, imagine that that is precisely what is taking place. You may go so far as actually to ask questions and answer them. For example, in the midst of your talk, you may say, "And you ask, what proof have I for this assertion? I have adequate proof, and here it is." Then proceed to answer the imaginary question. And that sort of thing can be done very naturally. It'll break up the monotony of one's delivery. It will make it direct and pleasant and conversational. Sincerity and enthusiasm and high earnestness will help you too. When people are under the influence of their feelings, their real self comes to the surface. The bars are down. The heat of emotions has burned all barriers away. They act spontaneously, talk spontaneously, and act naturally. So, in the end, even this matter of delivery comes back to the thing which has already been emphasized repeatedly in these pages, which is, namely, put your heart in your talks. When Christopher Reeve, who portrayed Superman in the movies, became paralyzed in an accident, he became a spokesperson for people who were similarly challenged. When Congress was considering an appropriation to finance research for dealing with such ailments, Reeve appeared before the Senate Finance Committee. From his wheelchair, even though his paralysis had made his formerly sonorous voice sound weak and sometimes difficult to understand, his message came through powerfully because it came from deep within him. His heart was in his words. His heart was in his words. That is the secret. Yet I know that advice like this is not popular. It seems vague. It sounds indefinite. The average student wants foolproof rules. Something definite. Something one can put one's hands on. Rules as precise as the directions for operating a computer. That is what I would like to give my students. It would be easy for them. It would be easy for me. Some speakers and professors have promulgated such rules, but there is only one little thing wrong with them. They don't work. They take all the naturalness and spontaneity and life and juice out of what is said. I know. In my younger days, I wasted a great deal of energy trying them. They won't appear in these pages. They just don't work. Do you do these things when you talk in public? We're going to discuss here some of the features of natural speaking in order to make them more clear, more vivid. I have hesitated about doing it, for someone is almost sure to say, "Oh, I see, just force myself to do these things and I'll be all right." No, you won't. Force yourself to do them and you will be all wooden and all mechanical. You used most of these principles yesterday in your conversation. Use them as unconsciously as you digested your dinner last night. That is the way to use them. It is the only way. And it will come, as far as public speaking is concerned, as we have already said, only by practice. First, stress important words, subordinate unimportant ones. In conversation, we hit one syllable in a word and hit it hard and hurry over the others. For example, Massachusetts, affliction, attractiveness, environment. We do almost the same thing with a sentence. We overemphasize one or two important words and virtually swallow the rest of the sentence. This is not a strange or unusual process I'm describing. Listen, you can hear it going on about you all the time. You yourself did it 100, maybe 1,000 times yesterday. You will doubtless do it 100 times tomorrow. Here's an example. Listen to the following quotation from Napoleon, and hear me strike certain words and run over others quickly. What is the effect? I have succeeded in whatever I have undertaken, because I have willed it. I have never hesitated, which has given me an advantage over the rest of mankind. This is not the only way to read these lines. Another speaker would do it differently, perhaps. There are no ironclad rules for emphasis. Let me read you these selections in an earnest manner, trying to make the ideas clear and convincing. Listen for how I stress the big important words and hurry over the others. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win but think you can't, it's almost a cinch you won't. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man, but soon or late, the man who wins is the one who thinks he can. Anonymous. Now let me read this paraphrase of a quotation from Theodore Roosevelt. Perhaps there is no more important component of character than steadfast resolution. A child who is going to make a great person, or is going to count in any way in afterlife, must resolve not merely to overcome 1,000 obstacles, but to win in spite of 1,000 repulses and defeats. Theodore Roosevelt. Now let me read you the famous poem by William Henley titled Invictus. Out of the night that covers me, black is the pit from pole to pole. I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Second, change your pitch. The pitch of our voices in conversation flows up and down the scale from high to low and back again, never resting, but always shifting like the face of the sea. Why? No one knows and no one cares. The effect is pleasing, and it is the way of nature. We never had to learn to do this. It came to us as children, unsought and unaware, but let us stand up and face an audience, and the chances are our voices will become as dull and flat and monotonous as the alkali deserts of Nevada. When you find yourself talking in a monotonous pitch, and usually it will be a high one, just pause for a second and say to yourself, I am speaking like a stone statue. Talk to these people. Be human. Be natural. Will that kind of a lecture to yourself help you any? A little, perhaps. The pause itself will help you. You have to work out your own salvation by practice. You can make any phrase or word that you choose stand out like a green bay tree in the front yard by either suddenly lowering or raising your pitch on it. It is the secret ingredient that all great speakers use to excite their audiences. And the following quotations, I will say certain words in a much lower pitch than I would use for the rest of the sentence. As you listen to them, ask yourself, what is the effect? I have but one merit, that of never despairing. Marshall Foch. The great aim of education is not knowledge, but action. Herbert Spencer. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Franklin D. Roosevelt. And finally, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. John F. Kennedy. Third, vary the rate of speaking. When a little child talks, or when we talk in ordinary conversation, we constantly change our rate of speaking. It is pleasing. It is natural. It's unconscious. It's emphatic. It is, in fact, one of the very best of all possible ways to make an idea stand out prominently. Walter B. Stevens, in his biography of Abraham Lincoln, tells us that this was one of Lincoln's favorite methods of driving a point home. He wrote, "He would speak several words with great rapidity, come to the word or phrase he wished to emphasize, and let his voice linger and bear hard on that, and then he would rush to the end of his sentence like lightning. He would devote as much time to the word or two he wished to emphasize as he did to half a dozen less important words following it." Such a method invariably arrests attention. To illustrate, I have often quoted in a public talk the following statement by James Cardinal Gibbons, Archbishop of Baltimore, Maryland, in the early years of the 20th century. I wanted to emphasize the idea of courage. So I lingered on certain words, drew them out, and spoke as if I myself were impressed with them. And I was. Listen carefully to this selection, and then try the same method and note the results. A short time before his death, Cardinal Gibbons said, "I have lived 86 years. I have watched men climb up to success, hundreds of them. And of all the elements that are important for success, the most important is faith. No great thing comes to any man unless he has courage." Try this. Say the phrase $30 million quickly and with an air of triviality so that it sounds like a very small sum. For example, $30 million. Now say $30,000. Say it slowly. Say it feelingly. Say it as if you were tremendously impressed with the hugeness of the amount. For example, $30,000. Haven't you now made the $30,000 sound larger than the $30 million? Fourth, pause before and after important ideas. Lincoln often paused in his speaking. When he had come to a big idea that he wished to impress deeply on the minds of his hearers, he bent forth, looked directly into their eyes for a moment, and said nothing at all. This sudden silence had the same effect as a sudden noise. It attracted notice. It made everyone attentive, alert, awake to what was coming next. For example, when his famous debates with Douglas were drawing to a close, when all the indications pointed to his defeat, he became depressed, his old habitual melancholy stealing over him at times and imparting to his words a touching pathos. In one of his concluding speeches, he suddenly stopped and stood silent for a moment, looking around upon the throng of half-indifferent, half-friendly faces before him, with those deep-sunken, weary eyes that always seemed full of unshed tears. Folding his hands, as if they, too, were tired of the helpless fight, he said in his peculiar monotone, "My friends, it makes little difference, very little difference, whether Judge Douglas or myself is elected to the United States Senate. But the great issue which we have submitted to you today is far above and beyond any personal interests or the political fortunes of any man. And, my friends," here he paused again and the audience were intent on every word, "that issue will live and breathe and burn when the poor, feeble, stammering tongues of Judge Douglas and myself are silent in the grave." These simple words, relates one of his biographers, and the manner in which they were spoken, touched every heart to the core. Lincoln also paused after the phrase he wanted to emphasize. He added to their force by keeping silent while the meaning sank in and affected its mission. "By your silence," said Rudyard Kipling, "ye shall speak." Nowhere is silence more golden than when it is judiciously used in talking. It is a powerful tool, too important to be ignored. Yet the beginning speaker usually neglects it. Listen to the following quotations that are said with force and meaning. Observe where you hear me naturally pause. "The great American desert is not located in Idaho, New Mexico, or Arizona. It is located under the hat of the average person. The Great American Desert is a mental desert rather than a physical desert. J.S. Knox. There is no panacea for human ills. The nearest approach to it is publicity. Professor Foxwell. There are two people I must please. God and Garfield. I must live with Garfield here, with God hereafter. James A. Garfield. It's not doing the things we like, but liking the things we have to do that makes life happy. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And finally, one ought never to turn one's back on a threatened danger and try to run away from it. If you do that, you will double the danger. But if you meet it promptly and without flinching, you will reduce the danger in half. Never run away from anything. Never. Winston Churchill. Speakers may follow the directions I have set down in this lesson and still have 100 faults. They may talk in public just as they do in conversation, and consequently, they may speak with an unpleasant voice and make grammatical errors and be awkward and offensive and do a score of unpleasant things. Your natural method of everyday talking may need a vast number of improvements. Perfect your natural method of talking in conversation, and then carry that method to the platform. In a nutshell, 1. There is something besides the mere words in a talk that counts. It is the flavor with which they are delivered. It is not so much what you say as how you say it. 2. Many speakers ignore their hearers. Some stare over their heads or at the floor. They seem to be delivering a soliloquy. There is no sense of communication, no give and take between the audience and the speaker. That kind of an attitude would kill a conversation. It also kills a speech. 3. Good delivery is conversational tone and directness enlarged. Talk to members of your community group just as you would to John or Jane Smith. What is the community group, after all, but a collection of John and Jane Smiths? 4. Everyone has the ability to deliver a talk. Use the same naturalness you use in normal conversation when you speak in public. To develop it, you must practice. Don't imitate others. If you speak spontaneously, you will speak differently from anyone else in the world. Put your own individuality, your own characteristic manner, into your delivery. 5. Talk to your hearers just as if you expected them to stand up in a moment and talk back to you. If they were to rise and ask you questions, your delivery would almost be sure to improve emphatically and at once. So, imagine that someone has asked you a question and that you are repeating it. Say aloud, "You ask how I'd know this? I'll tell you." That sort of thing will seem perfectly natural. It will break up the formality of your phraseology. It will warm and humanize your manner of talking. 6. Put your heart into your talk. Real emotional sincerity will help more than any formal rules or protocols. 7. Here are 4 things that all of us do unconsciously in earnest conversation. But do you do them when you are talking in public? Most people do not. A. Do you stress the important words in a sentence and subordinate the unimportant ones? Do you give almost every word, including the, and, but, approximately the same amount of attention, or do you speak a sentence in much the same way that you say Massachusetts? B. Does the pitch of your voice flow up and down the scale from high to low and back again? C. Do you vary your rate of speaking, running rapidly over the unimportant words, spending more time on the ones you wish to make stand out? And D. Do you pause before and after your important ideas? Errors in English. Review. There are 3 errors in the following paragraph. See if you can hear them. Neither of the cars were the type he wanted. As he often said, "It don't need to be a Rolls-Royce, but either of these automobiles are too cheap for a man like me." New study material. This is to be a lesson on the number of pronouns used with certain ordinary words. Rule. The words each, one, anyone, anybody, everyone, and everybody are singular, and singular pronouns must be used in referring to them. For example, here are two correct ways. He never let anyone feel that he had made a mistake. He never let anyone feel that one had made a mistake. Here's an incorrect way. He never let anyone feel that they had made a mistake. Here's a right example. Everybody said he or she had a good time. An incorrect example. Everybody said they had a good time. A right example. Anybody else would at least have said goodbye when he or she went away. And a wrong example. Anybody else would at least have said goodbye when they went away. A right example. Everyone ought to mind his or her own business. A wrong example. Everyone ought to mind their own business. A right example. Each of us is free to follow his or her own impulses. A wrong example. Each of us is free to follow our own impulses. And finally, here's a right example. Sometimes one just feels as if one had to rest a while. And a wrong example. Sometimes one just feels as if they had to rest a while. Rule. If you are talking about several subjects connected by the word and these subjects are preceded by the words each, every, or no, you must use the singular pronoun. Here is a correct usage. Each movement and each gesture has its meaning. And a wrong example. Each movement and each gesture has their meaning. Rule. If you have the pronoun one as a subject, you may use one's or his or her in connection with it. For example, one should do one's, or one should do his, or one should do her best before an audience. Correct usage of words. Egoism is an excessive love of oneself, or selfishness. It is the very opposite of altruism. Self-conceit is a flattering opinion of one's own abilities. Egotism shows self-conceit by words and acts. It reveals egoism. One may be self-conceited and have the good taste to hide it. Egotistical people parade their importance. Pride is high and sometimes excessive self-respect. It may be justified or it may be unreasonable conceit. A proud person may or may not reveal his or her pride. Vanity is a show of pride. The vain person longs to be noticed and admired and appraised. Vanity literally means empty. It is often applied to pride in such shallow things as dress and personal appearance. Imprudent literally means not seen before, hence, not taking results into account. Rash originally meant quick and has now come to mean overhasty. A rash person does things on a momentary impulse without deliberation. Foolhardy literally means a brave fool. The adventurous person gets a pleasure out of incurring risks. The adventurous person would rather join a startup business than to take a job with an established firm. Precipitate, like the word precipice, is derived from two Latin words and literally means head before or headlong. A precipitate action is like plunging headlong over a cliff. Other words with somewhat similar meanings are hasty, foolish, ill-advised, unwise, indiscreet, heedless, thoughtless, incautious, injudicious, impulsive, hazardous, and finally, venturesome. Voice exercise, bright and attractive tones. Here are three exercises which, if faithfully followed, will help to brighten your voice and make it more attractive. 1. Develop nasal resonance. Take a deep breath in through the nose and note the free, open, expansive sensation in your nose as the air is rushing in. Repeat the following syllables. Pitch them in the nose, dwelling on the NG sounds at the end of each word for 2 or 3 seconds. Let them ring in the nasal cavities like the sound of a bell. Singing. Bringing. Flinging. Hanging. Longing. Ringing. Clinging. Winging. Banging. And finally, wronging. 2. For some strange reason, practicing the falsetto voice develops a bright quality in our ordinary speaking tones. Do you know what we mean by the falsetto? I think you can get it by following these directions. Whether you are a man or a woman, pitch your voice in the highest tones of which you are capable, almost a shriek. It is a funny tone. It will soon tire you. Don't practice it after you begin to feel a strain. Try this verse in a falsetto voice.
A song, oh, a song for the merry May. The cows in the meadow, the lambs at play. The chorus of birds in the maple tree. And a world of blossom for you and me.
The poet Longfellow advised the famous Shakespearean actress Mary Anderson to read aloud each day some joyous, lyric poem to develop vocal charm. The happiness tones, the tones of cheerfulness and sunshine, are always welcome, always attractive. If you read aloud hopeful, glad poems and read them with feeling, you will soon develop in yourself and in your tones the emotions you are imitating. There can be no doubt whatever about the psychological rightness of that statement. One of the guiding principles followed by leading opera singers has always been that there must be the joy of singing in every performance. When giving a talk, your hearers ought to feel that you are experiencing the joy of talking. Listen and then speak aloud yourself several times the following poem. Try to feel what the author felt when he wrote it. Try to make his spirit your own. Let it ring and sing through your tones. Write this poem down, written by Robert Loveman, and read it aloud often. Better still, memorize it and dispense with the book. It isn't raining rain to me. It's raining daffodils. In every dimpled drop I see wild flowers on distant hills. The clouds of gray engulf the day and overwhelm the town. It isn't raining rain to me. It's raining roses down. It isn't raining rain to me, but fields of clover bloom, where every buccaneering bee may find a bed and room. A health unto the happy, a fig for him who frets. It isn't raining rain to me. It's raining violets.